It's also true of the undocumented people that are here. If they have children here and the children are born here, their children are U.S. citizens. So that now with this new law and legalization, or the amnesty perhaps is what you have heard it called, they don't have to apply for that for those children, just for those that were born outside of this country. Many of these by now are second, third, or fourth generation Hispanics. Many of them retain some of the Hispanic culture to some degree. You have kind of two extremes where Hispanics are trying to integrate themselves fully into the dominant culture, the North American culture, or Anglo-Saxon culture as they call it. And on the other hand, you have many Hispanics here who don't want to integrate at all. They want to retain their culture from Mexico or wherever in Central South America they have come, and not integrate, not take on the characteristics of our culture. And they only do that under protest if they have to make a living or to get along in this country. And in between then you have a whole gamut of people who are somewhat integrated or not, depending on their situation and their particular predilection for that. Many of them, therefore, by now have achieved middle class status because they have been able to go to school and college. Their parents went often to great sacrifices to send them through college. They get their degree and they become professionals and are able to live a middle class life and up into the upper middle class. And I think there probably are some too who are up what we would call into the upper classes. I'm not too knowledgeable about that. But there are others who have taken a very prominent part in political life or public life. Perhaps some of you have heard of the first Hispanic mayor in this United States of San Antonio, Texas, Henry Cisneros. Well, he's a graduate of Harvard. And a man that's got a tremendous amount of talents, and he was elected there at San Antonio. Some people thought it was kind of a fluke, but it seems to me that it was kind of a moment when that had to happen, because San Antonio, Texas is for about 50-60% Hispanic. Some of these people have really become more American in their way of thinking than they are Mexican or Latin from Latin America. A lot of them have left behind many aspects of their culture and have been so trained in the life here that they think pretty much like you and I would think. Then we have a lot of others who are living here who are aliens, but are documented. That is, they have applied for and received permission to reside here as permanent residents, or temporary residents, perhaps. They too more or less integrate into the life of our dominant culture. Those who really are residing here on a permanent basis most often want to integrate. And the reason that most of them came here are the same reasons that most of our parents or grandparents or ancestors came to this country, to find a better opportunity to make a livelihood. These people, along with the ones that are born here, are for the most part English-speaking Hispanics. Many of them do not know Spanish or know just a rudimentary Spanish, and even though they can speak it, very often they can't write it or read it because they've never been taught at all in Spanish. So they are seeking their economic advantage and trying to climb up the economic ladder or the social ladder, just like most of North Americans are doing. But we also have many, many others in this country who are undocumented. And they pose a big problem for a lot of our people who think that this is a big problem for our country. it's hard to tell how many undocumented people there are, how many undocumented Hispanics there are. Some estimate in excess of perhaps 7.5 million undocumented people in our country. However, they probably only form approximately 45% of all the undocumented people in this country. There are probably more Canadians undocumented in the United States than Hispanics. I read not too long ago about a whole group of Irish living in Boston who are undocumented, and they're all up in the air just like the Mexicans and the other Hispanics about what's going to happen to them with this new law. So you have all kinds of different people. They've come in through Canada, they come in through Mexico, or in different ways. And so the whole law about immigration, although the big talk is always about Mexicans and keeping control of our border with Mexico, seems to be the big thrust and what most people think of, actually has a much wider application than that. So it's quite an important thing in our history here. The situation of the undocumented Mexicans, especially and Hispanics, is really quite sad. They are distinguishable because of their language, because of the color of their skin, because of their way of dressing. Most of them are agricultural workers. And if you see them riding down the street or down the highway in a car, you can just tell who are the undocumented and who are not. A lot of the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service agents, are very, very adept at recognizing who is and who is not an undocumented, especially along the southern border. These people live under a good deal of economic oppression, kind of political oppression. One of the books that I have here on the table, Culture and Christianity, I think is the name of it, calls it economic oppression, educational oppression, political oppression, welfare oppression, and other kinds of oppression also in public life. They have been socially marginated from our society, from our life. They live kind of in pockets. They have to live by themselves, not only because of their language, but because they simply are not accepted into the main life stream of the places where they live. They get lowest pay. Many of them work for minimum wages, although they work 9 to sometimes 13 hours a day during harvest season and so forth. The housing that most of them live in is very poor. Some of them are beginning to be able to buy their own houses, but the ones that I have seen so far of the undocumented, the houses are just about as poor as the housing provided by the employers. By the way, in this state, adequate housing, medical, and water facilities are required by state law for all of the workers, even if they are undocumented. There's inadequate medical attention too in many cases. In Toppenish we have a farm workers clinic which is run by the state, which gives a lot of service to undocumented people, and for kind of on a sliding scale depending on how much they can pay. So they don't have to pay for the total cost of the medical care. But in many other areas, there is no such thing. They can't go to a doctor, or they're reluctant to because they don't know how to speak the language, or the people in the hospital don't know how to speak the language, or in the clinics. And so they're not really sure how they can communicate. Also, dental health care is a very big problem for a lot of them. So we have all of these different kinds of problems. In education, for instance, the children, particularly the migrant workers that go from place to place, their education is chopped up into little bits here and there and elsewhere as they are moving around following the crops and picking the crops. So those children are very, very far behind. They speak, probably most of them speak a good Spanish, and they also speak some English because they have to learn it in school, but they can't write Spanish, and they can't write English very well, and they get mixed up between English and Spanish. Children that are steady in school and go to school, once they learn English, pretty well want to use the English. There's a lot of peer pressure. I'm sure you understand that. But they can separate the English and the Spanish, and they can begin to speak both rather well, although it takes a little bit longer for many of them. The older they are, the longer it takes. So we have all kinds of different problems here. If you want to, after a while, I just have a few more things that I think I'd like to say tonight. In the question period or discussion period, you want to talk a little bit more about that, we can do that. But beyond all of that, what we might call oppression of different kinds, they encounter a good deal of prejudice and discrimination. Now, I don't know how all of you feel about Hispanics. You know, I don't know how many of you live around where there are a lot of Hispanics, but we live in the Yakima Valley where there are 70 or 75, perhaps 100,000 permanent Hispanic residents that now live there year-round. And we encounter a lot of prejudice, a lot of bad feeling against them, even though they are seen to be very, very essential for all of the fruit and the harvesting and so forth, the vegetable and truck gardens as well, very, very essential for the harvesting of all the crops. But people tend to deal with them on one level as employees and on another level as human beings. And that we see that happening even in the churches. They're often unwanted, but they're tolerated because of economic necessity. Many of the growers have said in the past year or two, when this whole immigration bill was still pending in Congress, that it's an absolute essential to have these undocumented workers picking the crops, because they can pick much faster, they'll work much longer hours, and they do a better job. They treat the fruit better, not so much of it gets bruised, and there's an abundant number of them, that if they were not here, there would be a lot of problem harvesting the crops. And we did have a couple of weeks of some real concern in the Yakima Valley when the cherries were harvested, because there were not enough cherry pickers. There were different factors involved there, but one of them was that some of the people that have been living here for a good while, the undocumented workers, with the new law going into effect, knowing that they could not be eligible for amnesty here, and knowing that if they stayed on as undocumented workers, they wouldn't be able to get work because their employers are going to ask for their papers from now on, they just decided to leave and go back to Mexico. Quite a large number of them did that. So that was one of the important factors in that. All of this has, for the undocumented people, has kind of created a subculture, you might say, or a second-class citizenship, even though they're not citizens, okay? A second class of residents and inhabitants in this country, who often, therefore, are thrown onto the welfare system. If their children are citizens here, they can receive welfare for the children, not for themselves. The parents can't receive for themselves, but they can receive help for the children, like aid for dependent children and other forms of help, federal help. And many of them begin to depend on that, and you'll find among many of them a kind of a mentality on dependency that has been built up. They have a lot of pride. They're willing to work, and they're willing to work hard, but they're seasonal workers, and on the off season, very often they depend on whatever kind of help they can get, and often it isn't enough to heat their homes. My wife was in one home about a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago. She talked with this lady, and she needed to write something. She had to put on her gloves to write. The home was so cold. It was unheated in the midst of winter. And we have some pretty cold weather in the Yakima Valley, down below zero very often. This was below freezing anyway. So they have this multitude of problems. Now, in the Yakima Valley, I will just throw in here that we are working primarily with these people. Some of the people that we are serving are our citizens, have been born in this country, but still live on the lower economic level. But most of them are undocumented workers. You may have some question about that, and we can discuss that if you want to do that also later on. The question that I want to bring up tonight is, though, given this kind of reality, this kind of way in which the people have to live, how do we reach those people with the gospel? Because most of them, having come from rural areas in Mexico, where the priests are very few and far between, and often in many cases do not reach out to the people on an individual level, partly because they can't, they don't have time enough, and partly because in the Hispanic society, in the past at least, many of the priests were dealing more with the upper classes than they were with the lower classes. These people don't have a great knowledge of the gospel, and often no knowledge at all of the gospel. They perhaps have been baptized, they perhaps have received their first communion, but that's about all, the private religion, the folk Catholicism that we talked about yesterday also plays in here a good deal. So they need to know the gospel, they need to know about the Lord Jesus Christ, that he's not just a dead and dying Savior that was crucified on the cross, but that he's also the living and resurrected Christ. And that's what we ended up with yesterday. That's so important for them to know. How do we do that? How can we reach out to them in the situation in which they find themselves? Because we belong here to the dominant culture, and they belong to a different culture, and with all of these different ramifications, that becomes a problem. As you look around at Hispanic outreach and Hispanic ministries in the different denominations, in the United States, it seems like for the most part we have reached out to them in the same way that I was describing yesterday, that we did in Latin America, with the U.S. Protestant models of reaching out to the people. There are only about 10 to 15% of these Hispanics that are living in the country who are active Roman Catholics. However, we have tried to bring them into a parish model, into forming congregations in which they take responsibility for the work of the church and for the support of the church, and that is very foreign to their whole cultural understanding and their whole religious connection with the church otherwise, because the church in Latin America is supported by the hierarchy. And the people down below, where they know that the money comes from, probably from heaven, because these are holy men, you know, that bring the money down from somewhere, but it isn't from them, for the most part. And they have no sense of belonging to the church in the sense that this is our church, and we have to pay for it, and we have to take care of it. And in addition, because the people are very poor, I'm thinking mostly about the undocumented, but not only them. Many of them are very poor still, the vast majority. They don't really have the resources to get money or borrow money to put up a building and to hire or call a pastor and pay him and so forth. The one model that probably is mostly has not followed that parish model that we have, or the one church that hasn't followed that. It's probably the Assemblies of God in their Hispanic branch of the Assemblies of God. They are much freer. They choose the people for pastors who haven't had so much training. They're laymen, and they receive on-the-job training sometimes. And they also help support themselves, or maybe entirely support themselves, in regular work and do their parish work in their free time. There's a question in my mind whether the whole parish model that we are so used to, getting a few people together, building a church, this is more or less our territory, our turf here that we're going to work under, and we call a pastor and we set up all these programs of stewardship and evangelism and the whole ball of wax, okay? There's a real question in my mind whether that really grew out of the gospel, even though, to my knowledge, there's no Protestant group that is trying that or working on that model. No, we don't have a church building. Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
we don't
okay.
have church
no.
But
we are.
Paid by Missouri Synod Church.
I'm supported as a missionary by the Northwest District of the Missouri Synod, yeah.
Are there very many of those in the United States?
Like missionaries,
yourself,
you mean?
Like yourself. You work with this family?
Yeah, there's quite a few. We have, I think, about 75 workers now around the United States.
Do any of them have churches?
Some of them do, yes. Mm-hmm. Some of them do. The congregation that I was in San Antonio, Texas, had their own building. That creates its own problems, yes.
Well, I think this is one of the problems. Where do you conduct services? Do you rent a building? Or?
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
We are using the facilities of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Yakima. That's in my area, okay, my bailiwick of the Yakima Valley Ministry. And Moses Garcia, his group is worshiping in Toppenish in Faith Lutheran Church, which is an ALC congregation. Ours is Missouri Synod in Yakima. Okay, I'm going to answer all your questions very frankly, okay? If something comes through that you feel a little bit of hostility on my part, it'll probably be genuine, authentic, okay? But there is a lot of problem, and I want to get into that sometime during the course of this week or next week. There is some real problem in trying to correlate the work, Hispanic work, with an Anglo congregation. It's not an easy task, okay? It's not an easy task for the most part. When we approached this congregation in Yakima for space to worship in, they decided that we could worship in one of the Sunday school rooms where they have Sunday school opening, but not in the sanctuary because it was going to be too costly to heat and to cool it, because we have to have our services on Sunday evenings. The people all work on Sundays during harvest season. That's all during the summer. Well, it's from about April or early May all the way through until October. They work 7 days a week. And so we have our services at 5:30 or 6 in the afternoon. And they were unwilling to do that. And at the same time, they asked that the Hispanic group pay $15 a week for the use of the facilities and to help pay for the utilities. Now, in part, let me explain before some of you jump out of your seats.
I'm ready to.
Okay. I think that the fact that the group pays something is important. I think it's an important training thing for the people to realize. For us to worship together, it's going to cost us money. And in this culture, we don't have money falling from heaven. It has to come from somewhere. Okay. And that they take that part of responsibility. Okay. And we didn't agree to it. I laid it all out in front of them, what the congregation was asking of them, and asked them what they wanted to do, and left it up to them. They had a choice of going to worship somewhere else, renting a building somewhere, or worshiping in somebody's home, or using these facilities, or maybe going to some other church for some facilities. We also asked a community center in southeast San Antonio. I checked that out. They wanted $250 a month, I guess, which we could have probably rented a house for that as well. So they had these different options, and they chose to worship in the church under those conditions. Later on, at one of the voters' meetings, this whole question came up again, brought up by one of the pastors of the congregation, and I was there, and it was passed that we could use the sanctuary if we wanted to. Okay, anytime we feel like we want to do that, we can do that. And the group decided they would like to do that, particularly now, even though the group is very small, if there's baptisms or some kind of celebration like that, First Communion, confirmation or whatever. But for the rest, to stay in the room where we are. But if we grow very much, we're going to have to move out of there because it's not a very large room. We can seat perhaps 50 people at the most. So that's that situation. In Toppenish, the congregation there, the ALC congregation, was a little more open, and they just opened the whole thing up to them. Okay? They have their services right there in the sanctuary. Okay. How much of this, how much of this is conducive to bringing the gospel to people, and how much isn't? That's one of the big questions that we are wrestling with, and I don't know that we have too many answers about that. Some of the questions that arise in my mind are for instance, can Christian nurture be only done or best done in a congregational setting? Might it not be better to do that in the homes or in a small group setting and have various small groups? Does a pastor have to do all of this, or can we train laymen to be group leaders for the small groups? The whole basic Christian community idea that's taken such a great hold in Latin America, can we find better ways of teaching the people that agrees more thoroughly with their culture and their ways of thinking and their ways of doing things without doing harm to the gospel? How can we keep from setting up barriers to the gospel rather than tearing them down? And all of these things need to be discussed and wrestled with. And I think my wife gets kind of tired of me talking about it sometimes, but we keep at it, and it's kind of important. One of the strengths of the Lutheran outreach among Hispanics, and I include not only Missouri Synod, to which I belong, but ALC has some strong outreach too in the Southwest. And the LCA doesn't have as much. To my knowledge, there are only one or two of the AELC that have. But the new Lutheran Church apparently is going to make a very concerted effort toward this, toward multicultural outreach. One of the great strengths has been our teaching. And this seems to take a hold of the people because it ties in with their concept, their sense of idealism. They're very idealistic people on the one side. Let me just say, give an example. They want to have a set of laws that's perfect, that covers all situations, very ideal set of laws, and they'll work for that. But on the other hand, there's a kind of individualism that comes along and says, well, this is so ideal that nobody's going to be able to live up to it, so it really isn't that important, in actual practice. But the idealism is there. And as we come with the gospel, they have this growing knowledge of what the gospel is and what the scriptures say, and that seems to be very appealing to them. Though many of them will say, I can't live up to it, you know, I can't. The expression is, for if you understand Spanish, me gusta el evangelio, pero no puedo cumplirlo. I like the gospel very much, but I can't fulfill it, which betrays a kind of law orientation towards the gospel, but also this idealism and non-idealism, I guess I'd call it, the contrast that's there in Latin life, which explains very much of how they act. Yes, Roberto. I think that ties in with the idea, this idealism, you know, that the church somehow is a total, a kind of a perfect totality, that if you're there, you have to be that way, you know, have to be a part of it, a part of its perfection. And that is a misconception, of course. Probably for your brother over a period of years, the best course would be, besides your talking to him, just to let him see how you live, and that your being in the church hasn't meant that. And when that dawns on him, then I think the misconception will fall away. Yes. Most often they can integrate into other churches if they have mastered the English, okay, which most of them have, and they're pretty well accepted in some places. In other places, it's difficult for them because the congregations don't accept them.
They would be the leaders of these little groups if they would stay with them.
Yeah, they could. And on the other hand, oftentimes they go into an Anglo congregation, and they're, you know, they might be appointed to a board or something like that, but they don't really feel like they're being heard because they're so overwhelmed. If there's just a few of them, they're so overwhelmed by the Anglos. For those of you who weren't here before, we use the term Anglos to mean everybody that's not Hispanic, okay? So there's some real problems there. Those things, the big thing is if a congregation can actually really welcome them with open arms. When the people are very open, or the majority of the people are very open to doing that, they can come and fit into the situation. If not, they will tend to stay with the Roman Catholic Church and their own Hispanic groups, or form their own congregations eventually if they feel strong enough to do that.
Are there any Hispanic ministers amongst the Protestant churches?
Yes. Yeah, we have quite a few. Of the 75 workers that we have, I would say probably 2/3 or more are Hispanic. I think for many of them, their concept of joining an Anglo church, if they have gone up the economic ladder, they see that as also part of getting up into the middle class, okay? I don't think that's necessarily, I'm not sure that it's necessarily a goal. What I said is, when I said they could, what I had in mind at least was that if the congregations, the other churches, will receive them, if they find a welcome there, then they can do that. Some of them, of course, you have all kinds of reactions. Some of them will want to go. They're anxious to go. They may have had some friends, some Anglo friends in this church, and they want to go to church with them, you know, and be in the same church with them. There's all kinds of different motivations. Mm-hmm. I think you will find, as a general rule, and my apologies to any of you who are people that live in rural areas, but that the rural areas are much more closed to that than in the larger urban areas. But there's a lot of it in the towns too, in the cities.
I'm hoping that it's improved some in 20 years.
Yeah. The Columbia Basin, you mean the Tri-Cities?
No.
Borden. Okay. Okay. That wasn't named after Lizzie Borden, was it? No.
No, Borden.
Okay.
They will also share what they have heard from us in whatever manner they hear it from us. And we think that that is an extension then also of our outreach.
Okay, let me say, and just put in other terms there, what has been said. That's really the way that I came to the Yakima Valley. I clarified or tried to clarify that with the mission board, that's the way I wanted kind of to work, and that's the way I thought it would be best to work as you expressed it. Let me put it in some other terms here that might touch you in a different way. I think for Hispanic ministry, this is my own convictions and my own reflection, results of my own reflection, that outreach has to be relational, not programmatic. We tend in our thinking, North American thinking, to set up programs and that through programs and through boards and through committees and through this and through that, we're going to do a lot of things. For the Hispanics, it is a personal thing. The person is much more important than anything else. Your relationship to other people is the thing that they will lie to you, straight in your face, a bold-faced lie, in order not to break a relationship. It's that important for them. And it's not, they don't feel that lie is wrong for that reason, or for just because, you know, I would come up and say with a propositional truth, the scripture says you shall not lie, okay? That's true. That's what the scripture says, and people should not lie. But they don't see it that way. It's more important to maintain the relationship, and therefore the lie is not what we would call a sin. See, that's a different way of thinking, and you need to be open to that. That's their way. The repentance for that sin can come around in a different way. You can get at it in a different way than just saying, well, it's a sin to lie, you know, and you told me a lie. And therefore, that breaks the relationship. For them, it was an attempt to keep the relationship. But that's so important, because you cannot really communicate with Hispanics, especially with Mexican men. I'm going to talk mostly about Mexican and Mexican Americans, because that's who we've been dealing with, okay? And they're in the large majority, I think, in most of the United States, except in places like New York, where Puerto Ricans are, or Miami, where Cubans are. But a Mexican man is closed. And the women are too, to some extent, but not nearly as much. They will not reveal themselves. That's part of that whole machismo concept, okay? The macho image. That you are lowering yourself, or you are diminishing yourself by telling somebody something that you don't want to, that you don't want to reveal, okay? And so until you have built a relationship and a relationship of trust and confidence, he's not going to talk to you. And if you talk to him and tell him what's right and what's wrong and all of that, he'll be extremely polite. And he'll agree with you down the line in words, but he will not be convinced. And it will create a much greater barrier for you to reach him later on, because he will look down on you, I guess that's a good way to say, for trying to change his ideas. And his ideas are uniquely his, and his ideas are just as good as my ideas are for me. That's the way he thinks, okay? And so until you can build that relationship, and very often it needs to be somebody that is more mature, like this nurse, I take it that she was not a very young girl.
55.
Okay. She's more mature, and therefore she has more wisdom in life, more experience in life, in the thinking of the people, okay? And therefore, you can listen to her more. okay, or to me. But always, once that establish that relationship, that they say in Spanish, confianza. You'll hear that very often. I don't have confidence in him. Okay? That means there's no relationship here. So I can't trust what he says. I'm not sure that what he says is right, because I don't know him as a person. Okay? So that's very important. That's why relational work with Hispanics is so important. Home visitation is very important, because that's the man is king in his home. If you can find him at home and talk to him at home, he has to, out of a cultural necessity, he has to receive you graciously. He's your host. And that's an important concept. Okay? He'll listen to you in his home where he wouldn't listen to you out on the street, because you're his guest. But at the same time, we, if it's cross-cultural thing, I need to be much more aware of whether that relationship is starting to be built or not, whether he has any sense of relationship with me for one reason or another. Because once that happens, then I can talk freely. Or if he chooses me to be the godfather of his child, then I have become a member of his family. And not only that, kind of a mentor, a counselor for him. He sometimes will ask me to do for his children, to train his children, instead of he himself doing it. And if I had children, I would do the same, ask him to do the same for me. Because we're compadres, we're co-fathers of those children. It's a whole new relationship, and it's your family can be extended tremendously by this co-fathership. Okay, but always it's that confidence there. Can I trust what he says until I know who he is? And the Latin response is no. Okay, I think the first thing, there are several things that you need to do. One of the things when they hired the nurse was an important thing. I don't know if you really realize that or not. But the Latin view of life is holistic. My whole life is a totality, a unity. Okay. If you want to talk and save my soul, you also have to be concerned about my body, my family, my emotions, the whole ball of wax. Okay. And if I go there and I say I'm not going to do anything on a social level, I'm not going to be concerned about his health, or his children, or the education, or if whether they have enough food, or anything like that, and I'm going to deal with their soul, you know, and give them some spiritual food, you're not going to get very far. And very often it's the social aspect first that will draw them. Okay? Because if you can deal with them on other levels, then they will trust you on the spiritual level too. That's the last place, that's the last refuge of a Mexican man. That's where he will reveal himself last of all, is on the spiritual level. And you have to do all of these other things. My advice primarily is to become a friend. If you want to become a friend, make sure of one thing, that you really want to. You can't be phony about it. Okay? If the concern, if the love and the concern isn't there, if you don't feel that person is just as good as you, if you have a paternalistic attitude and saying, oh, these poor people, I'm going to do what I can to help them, it'll never happen. Okay? They'll see through that right away. They are much, much sharper at seeing phony relationships than we are. They catch on to that immediately, like children usually do. Okay? But if you want to reach out to them, you have a sincere concern, make friends with them. Invite them over to supper. Okay? Take them out to a show. ask them if, take a pie over to the house or something like that, you know. Show concern and don't push it. That's maybe going to take a long while. It might take a year, two years, 3 years before you gain the confidence of the people. I felt, for instance, when I went to San Antonio, Texas, I was there for 2.5 years before I felt that I had the confidence of all the members of the congregation.